Hello everyone, I'm Julius Gelstraat, student, business psychology and TEDx organizer.
I am Miklas de Kok and I'm a student, economics, law and business administration. And I'm also a TED organizer. And today we welcome Jeroen van Oud, co-founder and CTO at TechWolf, a company in the HR tech industry. Welcome, Jeroen.
Thank you. Yes, welcome Jeroen and welcome to everyone of you listening today as well. We have a podcast for this week, luckily, but it was close enough because actually the meeting here with Jeroen was pretty improvised, I must say. There were a lot of shifts in the planning due to we had the plan to move the podcast to a live setting, but then Corona hit a bit severely and the measures became more strict. So we had to improvise and Jeroen was so kind to join last minute. For which we thank you, Jeroen, for making time last minute.
Yeah, no worries. I had an evening to fill anyway, so this is as good as any plan.
Okay, great. And if I'm not mistaken, Jeroen or Miklas, you guys know each other from high school, or at least went to the same high school, I think.
I'm 2 years younger, so I didn't know really Jeroen, but I saw him on social media, so and his profile looked very interesting because he's also a young entrepreneur, and everyone who is has started an own company, it's always interesting to hear about their story. So I think Jeroen, maybe you can tell something about yourself. How did you enroll in your studies and how did you enroll in the ICT world, in the IT world?
Well, I always used to have a bit of a passion for computers. Both of my parents actually worked together in a small IT company. So you could say that we have a lot of computer related activities at home. And after high school, it was pretty clear that even though I was very passionate about mathematics, that I was even more passionate about, computer science. So I chose to start studying that in Ghent. But during my studies in Ghent, even though I really enjoyed it, I felt like there was more to learn still, or more to really specialize in. And my big passion there was machine learning. Initially, I was very focused on computer vision because I used to be quite the photographer, and I saw computer vision as a combination between my photography hobby and machine learning, which I thought was really interesting. So then I applied to study in Cambridge at the Department of Computer Science there. But along the way, I started TechWolf with my two best friends. And TechWolf is not about computer vision, of course. We're much more about NLP, so natural language processing. So I switched majors in Cambridge and specialized in it for a year. And now I'm back full-time at the company.
Okay. A few things here. First of all, Ghent and not KU Leuven. What's that all about?
I feel like this is a very specific question for you to ask. But I was actually born in Ghent and I lived in Kruisatem for a long time. So Ghent was kind of the obvious choice, nicely at half an hour away from home.
Just joking, of course. There's always has been this rivalry between the two universities. That's why I ask, but not insinuating anything, of course.
Of course.
Yeah, but another thing that I want to ask you about. You mentioned some I think industry specific terms that I didn't understand before when you talked a little bit about TechWolf. Can you maybe elaborate on that and maybe start with the story of TechWolf? How did it come about? Because you're one of the co-founders. And when did you came up with the idea? When did you elaborate it? And what's the process here?
I actually have my two friends, Mikael and Andreas, to thank for the very origin of TechWolf. Because at some point they come up to me and they said, like, we noticed this thing that isn't working very efficiently and we want to start a business to address it. And the thing that wasn't working very well from our point of view was that we saw that a lot of our students in computer science, despite not really having a lot of affinity with hospitality or working in a restaurant, did this as a student job. So they weren't using their programming skills or building websites as a student job, but instead they were working in hospitality. And we figured that a lot of them would actually prefer to sit in front of a computer and use the skills that they were learning about all day long. But we didn't see this happening. And the idea initially was to start a student staffing agency that would basically put students in student jobs where they put their newly learned skills to use. Now, we very quickly discovered that this was a bit of a tough business to be in, because in a typical staffing agency, of course, you have a much higher margin because you're talking about long assignments where you can earn thousands of euros for placing someone. But in student labor, where, for example, touching up a website might earn the student 500 euros, of course, there's no room for thousands of euros of margin. And the really big problem there is that to find the right person for the job, of course, you need a lot of work. You need to find someone to interview the people, to find out if they have like the right skills to work on this task. And of course, being computer science students, we decided to solve this with AI. And I think it's a bit of a stereotypical reflex to use artificial intelligence for everything as a computer science student. But that's what we went for. And very quickly, we actually discovered that none of us were too keen about actually starting the student staffing agency in terms of logistics, because obviously when, for example, a student wouldn't show up at a job, that would be our problem as well. And we figured that we were actually the best at the algorithm and not as much at the, organizing the entire logistics of the thing. So we decided to focus on the algorithm instead. And that was the very first version of the Skill Engine, which is today still our product.
What is the Skill Engine?
Basically, you can see it as an AI brain for skills. So what the Skill Engine does is it takes documents, so that can be a resume, a job posting, or even a blog post you wrote about some topic that you know about. And the Skill Engine, almost like a person, reads this document and figures out what your skills are from it. So if you have a resume that mentions, experience as an accounting intern, then the Skill Engine figures out what the skills are related to that. Or if you mention experience in specific types of, for example, within marketing, you could say, I can do content production, or I can do podcasting. And then we link it to the actual skills that are implied by it.
Yeah, but still there is like a huge bias between what people wrote on the resume and what they actually can. So maybe that's a problem for the Skill Engine, or do you solve this problem as well?
Well, I would say we're not in the business of solving the problem of people lying on their resumes. I think that's for somebody else to solve. But in general, because we use so much background market intelligence, our skill profiles are more accurate than basically anything out there, I think. The thing is, when you say I was an accounting intern, or I was doing this at this firm, because our engine has read hundreds of millions of vacancies, and it knows what this title entails. So even though you might dress it up a little bit with fancy titles, unless you're lying, Skill Engine will be pretty accurate.
So it's basically a high functioning reference checker, this Skill Engine.
Well, so I wouldn't necessarily say that, in the sense that the getting the skills from it is only the first step, of course, because to work with the skills, you need to know what the skills are. But the Skill Engine also understands what each of the skills means. So for example, just from reading all of these documents, the Skill Engine knows that Microsoft Word and Excel are part of the same software package, and that for graphic design, you need Photoshop. So it has all of this this background knowledge. And the next step, really, once you have your skill profile inside the Skill Engine, is to ask, where do you want to go? So if you're saying that your ambition is to be a CFO in some time, now we can tell you what your skill gap is. We can help you recommend courses to bridge this gap. And really what we do as a company is we don't just apply this for individuals, but we apply this for large enterprises. because they really don't know often what their skills are. So it's basically like a skills inventory, because companies will very often know exactly what is in their warehouses. But if they take a look at their employees, then basically the skill set that they know of boils down to a single job title, their current job title. But when we see companies that need to restructure, and this is happening more often than ever, then basically this is a huge obstacle, because they only have this single dimensional view of what people can do. And with the skill engine, you can know what people actually have in terms of skills. So if you need to make a transformation with your company, the skill engine can allow you to make this transformation intelligently. And instead of the situations where we see thousands of layoffs and then 1,000 more people being rehired with different skill sets, you might be able to transfer a lot of people from their original positions to the new ones.
So actually there is a value creation, not only for companies, but also for people, for employees as well.
Yeah, that's something that we're, very big on in general, that it's not just a profit generating application of AI, but also one that really promotes durable HR, a bit like the circular economy, where instead of saying like these employees have lost relevance to our business, so we won't be needing them anymore, that you actually act proactively and reskill them before that even becomes a case.
And how do you gather all the data?
So basically there's two types of data we use. So there's the external data and the internal data. So internal data from the companies that are our customers, we very strictly guard within their own private environment. So this is information they trust us with. We put it in a, secure database that is entirely separated, and it never leaves this environment, because of course it's a company's data. And they wouldn't want it anywhere else. But we also use external data. So that's the labor market data that I mentioned earlier as well. So basically, you can see it as the skill engine reading millions and millions of vacancies every month and figuring out what's happening in every part of the market, what skills are, trending and which skills are disappearing. And that way you can not just compare what your company is doing in terms of skills evolution to the market, but you can also see what skills are emerging that you haven't really heard of, or what transitions are happening that you might not be aware of.
Yes, I think you mentioned the CV screening aspect of the skill engine. And I think what that solves for me is a phenomenon that you often see when people set up their CV, which is that they undersell themselves without knowing it, that they put on competences on their CV, which they don't elaborate enough because they don't know what the employer values in those skills. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, and you can respond on this, that the skill engine would solve a problem like that, because, like you said, they may be connecting dots with what this skill really means in the broadest sense as possible.
Yeah, I think that's definitely one of the advantages. What we're also very proud of is that the skill engine allows you to have a more objective view of what skill sets are, because, just like bias is a very big thing in machine learning, of course, bias is also a very big thing in human recruiting, because recruiters on average have about 7 seconds to take a look at your resume and decide whether you're going into the shortlist or not. And the skill engine, basically has all of the time in the world to figure things out. And I think that really helps, because if you have the same resume, even with the exact same text, but different styling, one being very basic and one being quite fancy, then you will not have the same odds of getting the job. And we feel that these cosmetic differences are often also not really valid differences between different candidates.
Yeah. And who are your clients? Do you have a lot of? I just want to, first of all, maybe it's helpful to ask how long TechWolf already exists, because I'm not sure. I've missed it, but I'm not sure if you talked about the start of TechWolf a bit.
Yeah, so we started, well, officially about 2 years ago. I think we started writing the actual code about 3 years back. So we had some time to prepare for starting the company. But we've had a bit of a transition, of course, from the initial idea of being a student staffing agency to selling the algorithm more towards HR service providers. And now we have a focus on enterprise customers.
Yeah. Because it was just such a coincidence, but today my father, he sent me a podcast that might interest me, and indeed it interested me, about Jan van Akkeleien, the chief HR officer at Proximus, who talked about HR tech and what's new and what's hot in HR tech. And he had some interesting insights, such as the fact that for him, what is lacking for the moment in HR tech is the scope that HR tech companies have, which is more Belgian based than it should be. He says they should look out in international scene more, because staying in Belgium, it's relevant to start. But you should evolve, if you're in the HR tech world, to more international partners as well. And I was wondering your opinion on this, this motivation for HR tech to move into international waters, to say so.
Yeah, I would say that, in my opinion, it's probably the only way that you can actually survive as a deep tech startup within HR, because obviously the cost of building such an advanced system, it's quite substantial. And if you only have a market as big as Belgium, then that tends to turn into a bit of a problem, because you lose your advantage, because there's players abroad that just have a bit much bigger market and the funding to really claim it, and then they come to Belgium. Now there's a bit of an advantage to starting in Belgium if you have the right technology, in the sense that Belgium is a very sheltered market, because we have so many languages here. For example, an American player will have a hard time getting any Belgian company to sign up for these things, because so much of HR data is just text, and they don't really support Dutch, French, and German all that much. But if a Belgian startup builds technology like this, like DeckWolf, essentially, then you do take that into account. So it's a comfortable place to start out with. But the market isn't big enough, especially with DeckWolf, we focus on large enterprises. So only if you have thousands of employees do you really get the biggest benefits from using this skill optimization. And to make this happen in the long run, you need to look at international markets rather than just staying at home.
Where is DeckWolf based?
In Ghent.
So the two co-founders are also Belgians who were studying in Cambridge.
No, we actually met in computer science in Ghent.
Okay.
So we studied together, and we founded the company 2 weeks before I left for the UK. So that was quite an exciting time.
Yeah. Met each other in computer science 101.
Yeah. I very distinctly remember sitting in the back of the auditorium with them and discussing bigger plans than whatever lesson was on at the time.
The back of the auditorium, the place to be to discuss things, right?
Of course.
Yeah. Then I want to ask more broadly about HR tech in general, and for people who are not familiar with the industry, because it's quite a specific industry. What is the scope of the technologies in HR tech? Can you give us an image of that?
So I would say right now HR tech is a bit of the Wild West of startups to some extent, because there is so much to do there. HR in large part is about, essentially there's two parts to it. I'm really oversimplifying it, but there's one part that is very, very human, very personal. There's the conversations you have with people. There's the coaching you do with people. And I would say their HR tech focuses on enabling, so building the right platforms, building the right tools to really allow people to engage more efficiently or make more out of the contact that they have. But there's also a second side, of course, and that's a lot of administration. So you've got payroll, you've got all kinds of talent mobility, putting people on different teams. And I think that's where the biggest revolution is happening, because especially if you look at AI, where does it succeed? Well, in repetitive tasks. And there's quite a few of those left within HR. So you see a lot of different HR tech startups coming up. And there's very, very different value propositions there. Like, it would be very hard for me to say, HR tech is all about this one technology, because you could start an HR tech startup that uses, computer vision. So, interpreting images to turn scanned sheets into something that works directly inside your HR system. But you could also build an app that helps employees to schedule their time off more efficiently. It's really, there's so much left to do that HR tech is very broad.
Yeah, it's all about efficiency and efficient data processing as well, right? Especially in the recruitment phase and selection phase. If you're a big enterprise and you have so many applications per year, that's really a gap that has to be filled yet. Right, so those data collection and efficient data processing.
I think once you start using that data more, it really opens up new dimensions to a lot of these processes, because there's for example, within staffing agencies, what we introduced with USG People, which is a customer of ours, is the metric of employability, which basically indicates how well positioned a person is within today's job market. So we look at all of the vacancies available in Belgium, and then we look at how suitable this candidate would be for different roles. And the nice thing about employability is that it summarizes all of this information into a single number that is also objective. It's an interpretable measure, and you can act on it. So if you have a candidate that has low employability, then you can find courses that will increase their chances of finding a job within today's job market. And this is something that can shift continuously. So you can monitor people that are losing relevance quickly. You can monitor people that are doing very well. And I think this is a dimension that you don't really have if you are unable to crunch all of the data, because you need this zoomed out perspective to really know where you are within the job market.
So actually, maybe it can solve the employment problem here in Belgium, the unemployment rate. Or don't you think there is no future for that, because the problem is not the lack of complementarity between...
Well, I think it's a large part of the problem. I don't think just adding the insight of where you might be able to find a job will automatically resolve the entire problem, of course. But I think a lot of it is about perspective and finding an actionable plan. And that is certainly something that you can do at scale using AI.
Is there in any, because you provide the tools, right, for efficient data processing, do you in any form interpret these data as well for TechWolf? For example, can you say right now, for all the companies that we've, if we applied this technology yet, I see these and these skills as really important for these and these students, or there's a gap really in graduating students on this competency, specific competency, or not?
Yeah, so we do a lot of these analyses. Of course, the ones we do for our customers are kept for their eyes only. That's a tailored analysis just for them on focal points that are their choice as well. But what we also do sometimes is analysis, for example, comparing the content of these degrees with what the market actually asks. Because, for example, if you take a look at, the typical curriculum for computer scientists and what is asked for a junior software engineer, you already see quite a bit of a skill gap appearing, because the technologies that you're being taught in university, they were very relevant couple of years back, but this is a very fast moving field, and the gap is opening relatively quickly and only being closed every once in a while.
Don't you think that a possible partner or an interesting partner for startups in HR tech couldn't be those institutions, educational institutions as well, to show them, oh, these are the gaps, and maybe change your curriculum to this or this way to bridge the gap.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a future in that. But of course, as a startup, you have some tough choices to make in terms of what to focus on, because if you try to do everything, then you usually end up doing nothing.
Yeah, I can imagine. Exactly. And your scope isn't really fixed on education for the moment.
Yeah, so we're not really focused on the education world, but rather on talent mobility and upskilling within companies, because that's where we see the biggest problem today.
Yeah, okay.
And do you apply the skill machine for your own company as well?
Yeah, every time someone applies for a company, of course, we calculate their match with the position that we're offering.
Yeah, of course. About, because I really want to touch again on the thing about student competencies and what is lacking, because the majority of our listeners are students. We are this is a podcast issued by TEDx KU Leuven, which is TEDx event at the university. So we're really interested in, are there any other generic competencies that you see that really should be more on the agenda of students to develop while they're studying?
Yeah, I think in general what we see is that on one hand you have the delay in curriculums adapting to the job market. So for example, with technologies like blockchain that basically are almost even on the way back down by the time they get into a course at higher education. But the second thing we see is the application of knowledge that is also not very present in a lot of university courses. Now, of course, I think that's more of a decision they make. But I think for anyone, it is a very good choice to really try and gain experience applying their knowledge while they study as well, because that really is something that can make the difference in having that best fit for a job.
And then we come back to the thing you did to where you started the conversation at the beginning with the first idea you had, then eventually leading up to TechWolf, where you look into student jobs and look if students can do student jobs that are actually relevant to their studies, instead of just being at the cashier at Deleuze, for example. Try to really have a student job where you apply the things you know, and That's part of what you're telling here as well, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Is there anything, because we had someone on the podcast before who stressed the importance of IT skills, and ever since we talked to her, it was Sanne Vermeer, I try to look everywhere for IT opportunities and where I can get better on this. I think that this is also an important gap, probably, that you must have noticed in really any discipline. I think it's relevant. It doesn't matter what you study, because it can make your works so much more efficient if you know how to handle Excel properly. Or even if you think, if you hear Excel and you think, wow, that's outdated, use another tool. Which are those other tools, etc.? Are there any tips you can give to students on where to find that to really go into the stream of the ever-developing world that is today?
Well, I might be a bit of a cliche, but I would say learn to Google really well. Because what we see is that often it's not necessarily about pivot tables in Excel, but rather about the ability that when you need them, that you can find out how to do it online. And this is something that we look at quite a lot as well. We've been doing research on learning ability, essentially, like how flexible are people to adapt to new skills on the job. And these digital skills are insanely important because, you don't really go to the library anymore to find a book to learn a new skill for your job, but rather you Google it and you find tutorials and you find the resources you need to learn these things. And I think that is extremely important because, especially for our generation, we're not going to have the same job for 20 years with just like the junior, media, and senior prefix in a row. We're going to have to change a lot more because companies are changing faster than ever. Technologies are changing. And if you can't keep up, that's a really big problem. But of course, if you can handle the technology, but rather just your computer and find information online, I think that removes a lot of the difficulty in staying with your job.
And how do you know if someone is able to do this? Because it must be also a factor or a variable in your system, in your skill engine. So how do you measure this, especially for students who just graduated?
So there's two separate parts to this. So one thing is that based on what someone studied, based on their experience, you can find out a lot about their affinity essentially for finding information online and learning things. So that's one thing that the skill engine can interpret. But of course, if, for example, in recruitment, you really want to put a hard number on this, then you can have a person do a standardized test rather than using the estimate of the skill engine. Because I think what we do is we use often limited information to gain a surprisingly accurate view on people. But of course, if you compare two people that might have studied the same thing and that's the only information that you have, if you want to know which person will be better able to adapt, then you need more information. And of course, you could feed it to the skill engine again, but sometimes that's just all you have, and then you proceed to interview them. So we're very strong on the idea that we don't want to cut people out of the loop, but rather we want to enable people to do more with the abundance of data that is there. So we're not really, the skill engine is not going to decide for you if you have two candidates for a job, which of the two you should hire, but rather when you had 1,000 people apply for a position in the past month or two, skill engine is going to tell you which people to look at again for this new position that you have open. So it's more about extending people's possibility rather than replacing them.
So is it possible to knock on your door as a graduated student to ask TechWolf which function, which company, which role can I play in an enterprise? What is the best fit for me? Or is that still not possible? You're still more of a B2B enterprise.
Yeah, we're very much B2B, but we're also working on a couple of projects that should bring some of the output to anyone online, essentially.
Okay, that's interesting.
I had a question in my mind. But yeah, I for sure wanted to talk as well about, you mentioned Google, and the one hint for you for students is to learn how to use Google. And a first question for me was, how should we use Google? And then as a second question on that as well, should we use Google and maybe not another search engine? Because Google has been on a lot of criticism together with the other of the big four lately, with a lot of antitrust happening in the US. Should we use Google? And if so, how should we use it? That's my question.
Maybe you should Google it.
But how, Miklas, how?
Yeah, I would say the question as to whether you should use Google is, for most people, almost irrelevant, in the sense that how can you even avoid using Google? Because,
to use search engines such as DuckDuckGo, for example, which I use right now.
Yeah, but even if you use DuckDuckGo, does your phone run Android? Did that website you just visited have Google ads on there? Especially in terms of data privacy, Google, Facebook, and a couple of other advertising companies are essentially so omnipresent that if you cut out their main application, like if you delete your Facebook account, Facebook is still going to know pretty much everything about you. So I typically don't tend to advise people to stop using Google because, it doesn't really make that much of a difference, I think. And even the profiling that Google does in the search engine typically just makes the results more interesting for you. So there's clearly danger in that as well, of course, because if you start Googling for political things, for example. It might start showing you things that you like because then you you visit more pages with more ads. So you have to be quite careful about that. But on the other hand, if you're well, for example, I'm a computer scientist. When I Google Python, I don't end up seeing articles about snakes. I end up seeing articles about programming language. And for me, that's very useful. But you should, of course, also be aware about it. And I think in using Google, well, there's a lot of guides online. But I think really the most important thing is just creating a habit of thinking about what you're searching. Because there's, even though the search engines, they're basically using natural language processing to interpret questions and try and offer you, this small screen that is above all other results that gives you the results straight away. So if you ask how old is Obama, you won't have to open a single page to see. But this also makes you a little bit lazy. And I think phrasing your questions to search engines correctly is a very important skill to have. And this is something that you can basically train by just doing it, because if you really keep on searching until you find something, then after some time, of course, you get the hang of phrasing things correctly. And it takes some adaptation, because every time Google changes their approach a little bit, then you might have to adapt. But of course, that's all part of the game.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What's your ethical position in this? Do you have some questions about it? Do you think it's ethically wrong or something? Because a lot of people are asking themselves questions about those search engines. Just what Julie's also mentioned.
Yes, and
of criticism.
And on that part, there's also the documentary that you're probably alluding to, The Social Dilemma, that has come out on Netflix, which I saw, and like we discussed, it can really bias your searches that you input into the engine. For example, one fact that the documentary points out is that if you type in climate change is in your Google search bar, it shows you another suggestion to fill the rest of the search.
Maybe we do the test.
Yeah, we can do the test, but depending on which country you are, it shows a completely different suggestion. For example, climate change is a hoax, or climate change is in another country a really big problem that needs to be solved. I don't know, but I think coming back to engines such as DuckDuckGo solve that problem. So maybe on that part, correct me if I'm wrong, it's better in that way to move from Google to another alternative, don't you think?
Yeah, I think it really depends on what you use it for. I think there might be an optimal setup where you use DuckDuckGo to inform yourself about things that basically have two sides to them or more sides to them. But when you're looking for non-controversial information, I don't think the echo chamber that is created by this personalization is as much as a problem. But I'll say that it is quite concerning to see the level of tracking and prediction that is happening often, because there's this, for example, there's this bit of an urban legend that Facebook records what you're saying because you might be talking about something and the next day you'll get ads for it. And I always think it's pretty weird that people think about this like that, because the truth behind it is, in my opinion, a little bit freakier, in the sense that they don't need to have your microphone captured to know what you're talking about and what you're thinking about a lot of the time, because they're not just tracking you, but they're also tracking, well, your friends, and they know that you're friends, and they know that you connected to the same Wi-Fi hotspot yesterday, so that you probably talked, and that this person just, well, bought this fashion accessory or this new gadget, and that you probably discussed it, and then you're targeted for ads. And I think what a lot of people fail to see is that you don't need to look into your mind to figure out what information you've seen, what people will be telling you about. And there's a lot of, very small data points that come together to really generate a really accurate profile based on your searches. Because, for example, I sometimes don't sleep very well. And I didn't really realize that this was a trend until I started getting ads for like weighted blankets and melatonin pills, like basically everything under the sun that you could use to sleep better appeared in my Instagram ads on Google, on Facebook. So I was so heavily targeted. And then I thought about it and I figured, well, probably I've just searched about bad sleep on Google one too many times and they've caught onto it.
Or yeah, maybe as far as the moments that you're active on your phone during the night, which shows that you don't sleep at the periods that you should sleep. And then they realize, oh, he has some sleep issues. And then, yeah, you can, if you think about it, there's some logical points where they collect your data. And they, of course, they should know, probably you're interested in that if they have a good data processor, which they have.
Yeah, and there's a lot of money to be made with very accurate ad targeting, because they might advertise their weighted blanket at anyone else and have like a 0.1% chance of selling it. But maybe in my case, they have a 10% chance or a 25% chance because they know that I'm looking for a solution and they're offering it to me on a silver platter.
Yeah. Don't you think that's scary at all? The manipulative ads that are on social media and on Facebook, for example, the because the end goal here is of the big four, the end goal is to keep you engaged on your screen as long as possible, because then they can show you ads and they can profit of it. And for them, we're becoming more and more of a product instead of someone whose time is to be valued. No, they just want us on our screens as long as possible, so that they can earn as much as possible. We're becoming more and more of a product. Isn't that scary at all for you?
No, I would tend to agree that it is. I think the use of AI in these situations, in these systems, it's very different from what we do with our company. Like one thing that we very explicitly don't do is train our models on what personal data. So we don't feed the machine resumes to learn what skills mean, because we want to have an accurate model of what skills are, rather than creating bias against certain people. A lot of recruitment companies, for example, use software that is trained on previous hiring decisions. But really what you're doing is you're training the system to replicate the bias that was in the recruiter's decisions. And similarly, I think like these models that are used to analyze our behavior, they are quite scary. But the bigger question there is, even when you're aware of it, and I think when you're aware of it, you can handle it quite well, as in when you know that they're showing you these ads because of one reason or because you've been searching for things, and you can look at the tags that they've assigned for you on Facebook and on Google, and you can even change them. So you can get quite some awareness and handle things to some extent. But there is really no escaping it, in my opinion. I think if you really want to escape it, then you just have to trade all convenience for your privacy. Because if you really avoid all of Facebook, all of Google, all of the other advertising things, like there's not going to be many apps that you can still use. There's not going to be many websites that will still work that well, because it's a bit of a cat and mouse game, essentially, where tracking and fingerprinting grows ever more advanced. Like if you visit two different websites with your computer and you remove every trace that was left by those websites, so not just cookies, but everything that could possibly be removed, and you change some settings on your computer, like they might still know exactly who you are, because there's a unique fingerprint in your device. And you might figure that because you use your laptop to visit one website and your phone to visit another, that they won't figure out that it's the same person. But all of this, so-called anonymous data is essentially combined. And they figure out that you're the same person, because over time you have such big patterns. For example, there's a New York Times article from last year on location tracking. So there's a couple of of companies that basically trade anonymous location data. But when you look at it, of course, there's no name next to every location that was tracked. It's just an anonymized ID. But if you look at it, then you can find out who people are very easily. Because, for example, if you characterize a person by approximately their the location of their home and approximately the location of their working place, then you can just find someone who has the daily commute to there. And it's not that hard to figure out. And I think that's a really big theme that we'll see in the next couple of years, the ownership of our own data. There's been a couple of projects that we've seen popping up, but I think without political support from the European Union, that's not really going to go very far, because really it's not in the interest of these big companies to have you own your own data, because that's essentially what the product is. Using the data to sell you things or to make you go to advertisers' websites or to target you.
Yeah. So you believe that what is happening in the US, for example, with the antitrust on the Big Four, that this is a useful step towards more regulation on that part and that it is needed, those steps?
Yeah, I think these things are important to really investigate very thoroughly. I think it's often hard to really make up your mind on these things, because if, for example, we look at Google and you see, all of the good things that they're creating as well, a lot of those would be completely impossible if they hadn't had this insane network of companies and if they weren't almost a monopoly, then they sometimes wouldn't be able to do these things. And there's also a lot of open contributions. For example, in machine learning, a lot of research is just contributed by Google, and all of this is open source, so you can just go online and download the latest language model from Google, and you can build something really smart with it despite not having to spend almost not even 1% of the actual cost of training this thing. But on the other hand, it is a bit of a problem, and if you stay in this situation for too long, of course, then you end up in a situation with less innovation. So it's a tough thing to make up your mind on, I feel, but it's really important that there is this watchdog and that this is being investigated. I think it might be a bit late to start investigating as well.
What do you mean a bit late?
Well, this was similarly done with Microsoft some years back, where essentially you saw that Internet Explorer and Windows were so dominant that nothing else could pop up. And it really takes a couple of years for these processes to really, gain some steam, because the companies, of course, they have the best lawyers and they can fight legal battles for a very long time until any action is taken. So it's not like, you can create new regulations and try to open up the market and make sure that innovation can compete fairly. But if every step is going to be fought, of course, then it's going to take a long time for this actually to have any effect.
Fast forward 20 or 30 years in the future, or maybe even 50 years, what do you think does the HR tech landscape or even the HR landscape, or even more broadly tech in general, what do you think it looks like? And also in terms of what we talked about for the majority of this podcast, about skills that are needed and the students, our children in the future graduating, what their grades, what their diploma will look like, etc. What do you think is the image of the future within 30 or 50 years?
Yeah, I think it's very hard to say for such a long period of time. But looking at what's happening right now in companies and in the market, I would say that we should prepare for a lot more flexibility than is happening today. What we're seeing within companies that are successfully adapting to changing situations is that they're becoming more agile. So instead of having fixed roles and fixed projects, things shift around a lot more. And really, if you take that one step further, you end up at the gig economy, of course. So where everyone is basically a freelancer. And instead of saying, I need a software engineer, you would say, oh, I need machine learning skills in this specific language with this specific topic. So if it's something about medical, you get an expert on that. If it's about something else, you just get someone else. And I think really where we'll be going to is this much more fluid economy where instead of having one fixed employer for most people, you basically end up with a lot of variety in what you're doing and a lot more focus on what you're good at. Because the thing is with artificial intelligence, anything that is done many times will eventually be taken over by AI, I feel. Because if we get so good at doing it the same way every time, then there isn't really a reason to keep the machine out of it. But there is one thing where we have a huge edge, I would say, and that's doing things for the first time. And to me, that is also quite exciting in the sense that basically, I believe that AI will help us take the repetition out of a lot of the things that we do and let us focus on the adventurous part, exploring the new ground.
Yeah, exactly. I agree completely. And that's also what frameworks such as Agile, Agile way of working aim to do, which is freeing up the short term to make way for the long term. Short term being the more operational tasks that we talked about, IT skills. Instead of doing something in 20 steps, you can do it in 3 steps, and everything that is just routine and is horrible to do as a part of your job is getting more and more efficient, will take up less and less time. And as a result, you can do more what you like and what you really wanted to take out of the job and really delete the operational. I think that's the basis of it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you have one final message for like one big message that you want to give to our listeners who are, remember, predominantly students, but also academics, and I don't know who else is listening, but one like thing you would print on a billboard sign along the highway that you would say, please, people, remember this. If you look at all the things we talked about, what would be that message that you would print out in big letters?
Well, I'm not sure if it would fit a billboard very nicely. But I think in terms of the skills, I think this is a mindset that is very important, where you don't just see yourself as, being this one thing. Like, you're not just a computer science student or a finance student, but rather you have skills. And you could say that the skills that you have are unique, and that makes you uniquely suited for different things than your peers. And I think moving towards the future, being aware of that you're not just, well, summarized by a single job title or by a single education that you took, is something really important. Because especially towards the future, I see like the traditional pathways in careers disappearing quite quickly. And if you're not aware of where you can go next, then of course all you have is this one title to depend on, and that pathway is disappearing. So be aware of your skills and try and be agile with those, I would say.
That's a very beautiful message.
Jeroen van Oten, thank you very much for this conversation. Last minute fixed conversation, but hell of a conversation and very interesting for me and for Miklas as well, probably. Maybe tell people where they can follow you or where they can follow TechWolf.
Yeah, so our website is techwolf.ai or techwolf.be. Doesn't matter which one you pick. And I also have a bit of a personal blog. I'm not very active on it, but you can find it on vanharte.be.
Okay, I'll check it out. I'm interested. Okay, great. And thank you again, and good luck in your future endeavors.
Thank you for the invitation.
You're welcome. See you guys. Cheers. We had some extra time, so this was episode 5 of season 2. Wow, what an episode. It was amazing to talk to Jeroen van Houten about TechWolf and about technology and HR. And you might wonder, how could this be better after this podcast? How could the content even improve after this? But don't worry, we'll figure it out and we'll provide you with content every week. So make sure to subscribe and follow. Thanks. Cheers. Our music producer is Paul De Peut, and thanks and shout out to Baptiste Vos, aka Tiest, our producer.